Does it get dark on Venus during the night? Which propulsion tech is the best for realistic interstellar travel? Which astrophysicist is my favorite and why? And in Q&A Plus, what research would I do if I was a scientist and not a journalist? All this and more in this question show. It's time for the question show. Your questions, my answers. As always, wherever you are, across my channel, if a question pops in your brain, just write it down. I'll gather them up and I will answer them here. All right, let's get into the questions. Smolk. With all that atmosphere on Venus, does it get proper dark on the night side or does it get only murky? No, it gets proper dark on Venus. So, you know, a day on Venus is very, very long. And Venus is actually flipped upside down. So it's turning backwards from the other planets in the solar system. We saw the images coming from the Venera program, which the Soviets sent these landers down to the surface of Venus. And so in the daytime, they were able to see features around on the surface of Venus, even though it was, you know, would have been very dim because you're down through all of that murk. And so not a lot of light is going to make its way down to the bottom of that really thick atmosphere. It's an atmosphere that is as thick as the ocean 1 kilometer deep. Like, it's a very thick atmosphere. But once it turns into night, then there's nothing that's going to cause that atmosphere to glow. So it's just going to get dark and hot. And so the temperature stays the same. Like, it doesn't cool down at night on Venus. The temperature just continues to be the same, like 460 Celsius everywhere on the planet. Whether you're at the poles, whether you're near the equator, doesn't matter whether it's day, whether it's night, it's that same temperature. Tricky Mick, is it possible that the strange orbits of the dwarf planets in the outer solar system were caused by an ancient stellar flyby? It seems like it could also have affected those orbits. Yeah, this is a legitimate theory. It's been proposed that a rogue planet flying through the solar system could have caused the jostling of the outer Kuiper belt and put the various dwarf planets into the positions that they're seen. There was a paper that we reported on that sort of did the math and found that you would need to have a rogue planet passing through at this velocity, at this distance, and that the orbits of the Kuiper belt objects could be explained by that process. So it has absolutely been considered and is a perfectly feasible theory. And of course, the problem with that is then you can't then track the object down. It's gone, right? It might have happened a billion years ago, and now you'll never know what happened. And so if we fail to find Planet Nine with Vera Rubin, then it's almost certain that that's what happened. That at some point in the last, you know, few billion years, a rogue planet came relatively close to the solar system, caused and, you know, passed through the Kuiper belt and caused a disturbance to the objects in the area. So at Oz de Merci, what is that one propulsion technology you hope to see become a reality in your lifetime? The one you think will finally make interstellar travel possible? Well, from what we know, there's really only two methods of propulsion that would make interstellar travel possible. One is a laser sail, some way of accelerating a spacecraft with a laser that is off of the spacecraft. And so you don't need to carry your propellant. You just get this gigantic boost. That sounds very dangerous. There's no brakes. It sounds scary. The other one is antimatter. And that if you could actually build an antimatter rocket, then the amount of delta V, the amount of change of velocity you could get, is feasible for you to be able to accelerate, fly to a nearby star system, decelerate, and be able to explore it. So really, the only game in town for us is antimatter. And so somebody needs to develop antimatter production at scale, antimatter storage, magnetic confinement, and some kind of antimatter rocket that will actually use the antimatter for that propulsion. It's good timing because we're going to watch Hail Mary this week, probably. And they sort of cover this kind of idea that they extract all of humanity's energy into trying to create enough fuel to send a spacecraft to another star system. And that's the kind of scale of energy production that we would need to set our society to. You know, people always ask, like, what's the point of a Dyson sphere? Well, maybe one of the points of a Dyson sphere is that you have antimatter factories all around your star. You're trying to turn all of the energy coming out of the star into antimatter so that you can then build spacecraft that can go to other star systems. Like, that might be the scale that this takes. In Armstrong, I was wondering if I could get a little clarity on the process. It happens the instant two black holes merge. Does that cancel out the spin rate of both black holes? So when two black holes merge, you don't cancel out the spin rate, you just essentially average out the spin rate. And so if the two black holes are spinning in the same direction, then the combined object is going to be spinning with the average rotation of the two black holes that came together. And in fact, this process is what sets a solar system spinning in the first place, that you've got this giant cloud of gas and every particle that's in the cloud has its own momentum. And that as these particles are bumping into each other and they're starting to glom onto larger things and they're starting to concentrate at the core of this gas cloud, then it starts to kind of shrink down and it starts to spin faster and faster and faster. And, you know, the classic analogy is the skater pulling in their arms, they spin faster and faster as they sort of make their axis of rotation smaller. And the same thing is happening to a solar system. And so it is spinning up, flattening out, and it is, you know, the direction, the orientation is just the average momentum of all of the particles that made it up. And so whenever you see a black hole, then its rotation and orientation is just made up of the average momentum of all of the things that came together to make the black hole. It's time to shout out all the new $5 patrons and above. Chris Trow, Steven, George Henry Schneider, Rill? I don't know. David L., Imago, Pete McGraw, Corey Stridham, Faskasur, and Richard Swan. Join the club at patreon.com/universetoday. Dougal, what would you say is the biggest benefit you've had with virtual meetings with every new patron? Yeah, so this is a thing that I do, and it's funny because it still shocks and surprises people that I do this, which is that whenever people sign up to become a patron, I reach out to do an interview with them, and it's like an actual video interview. So it kind of feels exactly like this. Except I'm talking back to you specifically. We are having a conversation. And the joke that I always make is that, you know, after this interview is over, you know, if you're going to be talking to your television from here on out, you've gone crazy. But in this moment, you're not crazy. And it is very, very valuable to me as a creator. So there's a couple of reasons why I do this. The first one is that creating material content on the internet is a kind of mildly punishing experience that, and I'm sure if you like went and looked through the comments just in this video, like there's lots of stuff, lots of great conversation. And then there's a couple of assholes, right? And they're just kind of saying things that are kind of negative. And yet our human brains will remember the trolls and forget all the nice things. It's hard on your psyche to create content on the internet, because it's just so reactionary and people are so mean. So when you actually talk to a fan of your work, or you talk to someone who actually watches your content, it's amazing because they have like actual useful, solid advice, but they also just make you feel grateful to be producing this content for people, that these are the kind of people and that they've been watching all along, and maybe they never said anything, but they appreciated it and they enjoyed it. And that just feels good. And that erases, it wipes out the negative experiences that you have with just the general populace on the internet, the trolls, the karma people, the people who are, you know, shills for various ideologies, right? So that's the first thing, you know, like a KGB, Russian troll farm isn't going to sign up to my Patreon and join me for a conversation, right? They're just going to snipe at me from afar. So that's the first reason. The second reason is like it's genuine actual feedback, that if we're doing things wrong, if we're making some mistake, or if there's things we can do that would improve, that's something that I'm going to hear directly from the people who actually know the content, right? Not the people who haven't watched the videos. I don't care what the people think who don't watch my videos, right? And are trolling or attempting to troll, they can just get bent. Who cares? But the people who actually watch the stuff and have feedback, then it can be very nuanced and very useful and very actionable. So like this search engine that we built for all of the question shows, that was, I got enough feedback from people saying, you know, sure, it would be great if there was a way we could search through all of your past question shows. Okay. All right, we'll do it. So that's kind of the next thing. And then it's just like, I love being able to give people this random surprise, right? A thing that they would never expect. Like, oh, wait, I get to talk to you, right? That's great. And it's very fun for me. And it doesn't take up a lot of my time. Like I do probably 5 or 6 interviews a week, and they're about 15 minutes. You know, maybe only a quarter of the people who sign up as patrons actually take me up on this offer and we do it. But it's, yeah, it's great. And it's, you know, I've only had like maybe one person try to use this as an opportunity to sell me on their pet theories about the cosmos. Most of the time they're, it's really cool conversations who, if I lived in the same city as these people, they would be my friends, right? Which is such a great experience. And you know that there's just like all these like-minded people out there around the world. So if you're a creator, and like, I know this feels like it's an impossible thing to do, figure out a way that you can talk to your fans on a regular basis. I've done 1,200 and something of these interviews at this point. I've been doing them for years and years and years, and I'm so glad that I do it. And I have never met anybody else that does this, and they should, because they're sort of, this is a chance to refill the your joy of the work that you do. Happy Butters Blast. Who is your favorite astrophysicist and why? Man, I don't have favorites. Like I talk to so many of them. So I'm going to go with John Mather. All right. Nobel Prize winner, John Mather, mind behind the James Webb Space Telescope, is just like the nicest human being you've ever met. He's so nice and he's so kind and he's so generous with his time. He just sent me an email about their new Starshade project that we reported on Space Bites. He's let me interview him like, I don't know, 2 or 3 times. So I would say, you know, he is both a brilliant mind behind one of the greatest telescopes that's ever been developed and has a Nobel Prize and is super humble and really nice. So there you go. There's my favorite astrophysicist. King Tad, Fraser, if you were a scientist and not a journalist, what would you want to focus your research on? What burning question would you focus your career on? I don't know. Part of the problem is just like the way my brain is wired, that I don't have the kind of attention span for doing the kind of long, detailed, in-depth research that might be required to make serious progress in one field. I would just be too interested in tons of other stuff. And so I would be much more of a dilettante. Like I might get my degree in one field, but I would be sort of picking up knowledge and information from other fields as well. But I also really kind of believe that you know, when you are like you get your bachelor's degree, you understand the fundamentals of science in your field. When you get your master's degree, you're starting to understand the nuanced aspects of your field. And it's not until you get your PhD that you are making actual progress in your field. Like the person who has gotten their PhD knows more about one specific little piece of that field than anybody else in their field. That's sort of what getting your PhD is that you are making a new scientific contribution. You're discovering something. And it's only then that you really understand the landscape of what's out there to be discovered and what the outstanding challenges are and what work is to be done. And so, you know, I think that I don't know very much at this point. And so I wouldn't know what would be a good problem to tackle and what would be a bad problem to tackle. Like, obviously, there are questions about the, you know, is there life in the universe? Where did the universe come from? What is dark matter? What is dark energy? But are they tractable problems? Are they problems you could make progress on in a scientist's career lifetime? I don't know. So there hasn't been a moment where I've decided that I need to spin up a bunch of books, write my paper, and send it off like a crank to physicists hoping that they're going to take me seriously. Like, it's weird. I don't even have hunches anymore. Like, I think when I knew less, I hunched more. And you'll see me do this in real time in a specific situation where I'll be asking an astronomer a question and I will be sort of trying to have a hunch and try to express that hunch in real time. And they'll be like, yeah, we thought of that. And, you know, here's why that's not a great idea. Or, you know, like no one's really looked into that. Oh, okay. Maybe that would be interesting. So yeah, that part of my brain is gone. As I have learned both the kind of the state of the reality, how complicated it is, and I've gained more respect for the abilities of actual scientists who are doing this work, my desire to contribute has gone to zero, right? Where I am my purpose is to communicate. And that is the thing that I try to think about a lot. How do I communicate this better? How do I do a better job of walking this fine balance between being scientifically accurate and telling interesting stories that people want to learn more about? And I think I'm too far removed now from having hunches about space. All right, those are all the questions that we had this episode. Thank you, everyone, who asked your questions into the YouTube comments. Everybody who joined me for the live show, which we record every Monday around 5 p.m. somewhere in the world. I know it's very tenuous, but there's an event here on the channel where you can see when the next one is going to happen. I'm going to give YouTube some kudos. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Andrea Pedretti, Barely Groofing, Brian Bodie, Caradwent, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Bela, Cooper Nelly, Dark Finga, Dave Giltonen, David Matz, Evan Dupro, Greg Feely, James Clark, Janice Smith, Jerry Madden, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Marcel Smits, Michael Purcell, Nordspace, OneStepForAnimals.org, Rink Heidi, Richard Williams, Sean Sargent, Stephen Feller Mundy, Team 49, Telescopes Canada, Vlad Shiplin, Wolfgang Klotz, and Zeldaborg Galactic Defender, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. So I've got to say, YouTube has been starting to get the slop problem a little under control. So there's a couple of things that seem to be happening now. The first thing is that if you just do a search for the kinds of channels, the kinds of topics that would have been slop bait in the past, for example, if you search for James Webb Space Telescope or you search for black holes on YouTube, then the videos that you get appear mostly to be legit to me. There are some recommendations for channels that you should be following, and they seem like they have a lot of slop going on in them. But just like in general, the search function doesn't unearth a lot of slop. It unearths like real videos. And then if you constrain, say, the search just for the day, so just show me all the videos posted about black holes today, then there's a ton of slop, but they all have no views. So YouTube is not promoting them excessively. They're getting whatever is their natural subscription amount, which of course is none, because nobody is subscribing to these channels because they're slop. So I think that this is working. And, you know, I had been saying for quite a while to YouTube, like, this is an existential problem. Like, if you don't get this under control, then YouTube will just be not a place that people are going to want to go. So the next step then is, you know, because, you know, obviously the people who are going to be making slop, trying to figure out how can you make as much revenue without having to put in a lot of work, is they're going to try to hide it, try to slop launder. Launder slop. And so you're going to need a way to be able to detect it, or a way to for people to have to chart how much AI they're using in their video. And then if you catch them, then they get penalized. And so I think that's going to be the next step. And then I think at the same time, and YouTube, like, nobody is using your tools for, you know, the recommended kinds of videos that you can do, the write a script for me, give me a thumbnail, like all of that stuff is not wanted, and I think is giving us all the wrong signals. And so, like, until the AI tools are like better baked in, I think you need to dial back and fight this, what is an existential problem for the YouTube platform. But like, just in general, it feels like YouTube is less of a sloppy place than it was in the past. And that feels good. It feels better. Obviously, as a person who tries to make, you know, do videos the old school way, that's important. And hopefully we'll find this happy balance. And, you know, and then maybe the AI will come back around, but it'll be under the hands of creators that are trying to make things that are interesting, as opposed to just trying to wring as much money out of the advertising algorithm as they can. So let me know, have you noticed that the amount of slop that you're having to sort of wade through has gone down for you here on YouTube? I'd be interested to hear your feedback. All right, we'll see you next time.